And that speech, sweet as dew. Romans 3, 19 to 20 today. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. For by works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes knowledge of sin. I probably could have added these two verses to the sermon from last week, but there's just, this has to be clear. And we can all hear it and understand it again, right? Works. Because sometimes you think you know someone so well, and then one day, where'd this come from? I found this with my mother as she lay dying of cancer. Now, my mother, a classic Dutch blonde, blue-eyed lady, I literally learned Jesus on her knee. Learned about Jesus on my mother's knee. She spoke of him all my childhood, I remember this. She spoke of him as if she knew him, and personal friend of hers, if you will. She quoted verses from the Gospels, took us to church, vacation Bible school, prayed to Jesus daily. So my mother, along with my grandmother and my aunts and uncles, and my boyhood pastor too. I had a very faithful, reformed boyhood pastor who preached Jesus to. These are the ones that caused me to know Jesus, the gospel of salvation by grace through faith. So imagine my surprise when I discovered on her deathbed that she thought that her life of loving people would stand her in good stead with God when she died. I wasn't quite clear what she was getting at. I wanted to make sure that she trusted in the, at this point especially, trusted in the gospel that is salvation by grace through faith, not of works, so that no one may boast. So I gently explained to her what we've been discovering over these last few weeks, the true basis of our righteousness and our righteous standing before God, right? Christ's work and our simple faith. Our belief in him, not our works. For a day or two, she was offended that I had implicitly criticized her. But I think there was just a misunderstanding. My mom was so loved by her church and her family and her friends for her love and her good works towards everyone. So in spite of the solid Reformed teaching to which she was exposed all of her life, she was still ready to fall back on her works in those last days. At least that was my thinking. But praise the Lord, after reading and rereading the Bible verses I gave her and thinking about what I'd said, she apologized for taking offense and agreed completely with me. She even said she remembered all those teachings and she was surprised at how she'd just, you know, forgotten them at that time. It couldn't be because she had a liberal set and series of ministers after my faithful conservative boyhood pastor. That couldn't be it, could it? I think it was in part because, you know, if you don't have the doctrine of grace preached to you for some 30 years, you tend to get a little muddied and unclear on it. So that was part of it. But fortunately, all this was clarified for her on her deathbed. What's really ironic is that my father was an opposite of my mother. All of my youth, he brought us to church, but had no heart or understanding of Christ or the gospel. My father only came to faith after he saw how my mother died. That is, in complete trust and faith in Christ. It's a beautiful thing to see. But once he did, he understood the doctrines of grace completely, very clearly. He read his Bible daily, prayed often, served as a deacon in the church too, an office for which he was unfit while I was growing up in the house. But the church recognized that something had happened to my father. Yeah, he got saved. He came to know Christ in a real and living fashion later in his life. So he also articulated these things very well, understood them. He'd just been able to teach us, my brother and I, as we were growing up in the house. But it was really sweet to see my mother and father talk about Christ and their faith together in those last days too. So some things, rewarding things have come to me in the lives of my mother and father there in those last days. But, you know, I was just thinking again all week how the works of the law mess with our heads, if I can use that phrase. How works of the law mess with our heads. Even continuing as Christians. Behold the intractable setting of the human soul. The default setting of the human soul. It is toward works, isn't it? Toward earning our own way to heaven. So, I want to underline this again, just for utter clarity. I know you know this. I look out there and I see that everybody I am assuming knows the things I'm going to be preaching on today, but maybe not. So, we have to make sure, and I want this clear in your heads and hearts and minds, okay? Before we move on, then, to Christ and His sacrifice. Very densely, compactly given for us, beautiful gem, the closing verses of Romans chapter 3 are. But 19 and 20 then, verses 19 and 20, 2 points I want to make with you. Works. The verdict of the law of God is that in addition to the high privilege of possessing it, which the Jews did, you who are under it are also accountable to God for keeping it, verse 19. Now, Paul is concluding his discourse from chapters 1 and 2 upon our utter desperate need for the righteousness of God. And precisely why we don't have it. And this is something that you have to bring to your lost friends and relatives and neighbors' attention. Is that while they are consumed with presidential elections and bad economy and whatever might be in our region, it's skiing right now. They may be consumed with these kinds of passions and concerns. And what do I care about the righteousness of God? Well, you may not care about the righteousness of God right now, but I'll tell you what, in the day of judgment, you'll say, I should have paid more attention. And bring these kinds of things to the attention of your lost friends, neighbors, and relatives, because it's utterly requisite for eternity. The righteousness of God, precisely why we need it, what it is, why we don't have it. This is what Paul's been outlining here in these chapters. His argument has been extended and overlapping 2.5 chapters now, precisely because of the intractable setting of the human soul. Gentiles without the law and ignorant of who God is, now we expect that they can think merit and a right standing before whatever God they construct for themselves in place of the God of the Bible is what they need. But alas, we discover that those who should know better, the very people who possess the oracles of God, as Paul puts it, they refuse to be humbled by them in understanding that they can never be justified in meriting justification because he can never do so perfectly, the Jew. Perfectly, the standard set for divine accomplishment. Now, he's bringing this home now to his Jewish brethren in a summary fashion. These two verses. Torah, when taken in its totality, is here, in this case, nation and race specific. That is, to you, O Jew. And given, as we read from the law today in Deuteronomy chapter 4, given to you, not that you might be high and lifted up as a Jew, just for being a Jew, that is justified just because you prance around in the mere possession of the law, with all of the majestic ceremonies and rites of the law, and indeed they were, as you read the Old Testament law and its implementation, the construction of the temple, the institution of the sacrifices, they were gorgeous. They were beautiful. And they were resplendent with the glory of God. This doesn't justify you, though, but because the very things that should humble you, then, the law and its living out in the life of Israel, it should humble and persuade you, O Jew, that you too cannot do this glorious law, you yourselves. But indeed, you fall as pitifully far short of it as do the Gentiles with their far less glorious revelation of law written on their hearts. That should be the upshot, Paul is saying. And think of how different, too. Think of how different Israel's history would have been had they had this attitude, this humble attitude. Certainly, they should magnify and glorify the name of the Lord in their worship and their living out of the law such that they would be a living evangelistic tool for the world. Some Gentiles indeed did see the glory of the Lord in Israel and the ceremonies of the law, the temple rituals, the festivals of Israel. And there were proselytes, were there not? There were converts. We read of them throughout the Old Testament and New Testament, sprinkled throughout the history of Israel. But think if they had been humble before the law and employed the law, lived the law as they should have, and said, we realize as well, we cannot match the glory of God and we cannot obey this beautiful law that God has given us. We too need redemption like you Gentiles. But here is the law of God revealed to us and hopefully to you. That's the upshot of the text that we read, verses 6 through 8 of chapter 4 of Deuteronomy. Keep them and do them. That is this law. For that will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples. This was evangelism for Israel, who, when they hear all these statutes, will say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. The idea was that the nations would flow to Jerusalem. For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord, Yahweh, the personal name of God? The Yahweh, our God, is to us whenever we call upon Him. What great nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law that I set before you today? So they didn't have the Romans Road. They didn't have the four laws. They didn't have evangelistic explosion. They had the law. And as they lived it out before the nations would say, what a glorious law given to you by this God, Yahweh. Instead, they became arrogant and boastful and sinful, sent into exile in Babylon when they declined into idolatry and destroyed utterly. Then in AD 70, when they became proud and exclusive for not relapsing into idolatry, they just couldn't win. Yeah. This intractable bent of the heart. Indeed, they were under the law, and the law spoke to them, but they didn't listen and heed its message. Instead of Torah being a tutor, as Paul calls it, instead of Torah being a tutor to lead them to Christ, Torah became a temptation to lead them astray into self-righteousness. Had they seen Torah aright and lived it aright, that arrogant, boastful babbling that we see all through the New Testament, Jesus rebuked it. It infuriated Jesus, did it not? The hypocrisy and the pride, the blindness, that arrogant, boastful babbling about being a Jew would have been silenced. They would have seen that despite their possession of it as stewards of the mysteries of God, as Paul calls that as well, they too were ultimately no better off than the Gentiles who do not have it. Because like them, they were true sons of their first father, Adam, being unable and incapable of keeping it to God's standards, perfection. And as a consequence, then every mouth would be stopped. Every mouth would have been stopped, even as we read last week, right? When Jesus said, let he who is writing in the sand, let he who is without sin then cast the first stone. And then consequently, therefore, the whole world, not just the Gentiles, you are all accountable to God. This is his conclusion. Now he's bringing before these Jews who are so adamant in their pride of place and possessing the law. Paul says, oh yeah, you possess the law, the oracles of God, you are stewards of the mysteries of God, but you don't keep it, and therefore you're no better off than the Gentiles who don't keep the law written in measure in their own hearts either. And this important truth has two continuing applications, too, for us. That is, for us, for evangelism, it gives the lie to diversity and tolerance. Not all religions are the same. All religions of the earth, indeed, have in some way, shape, or form a works-based righteousness. And that's been our tendency here in our country, is it not? To say, oh, yeah, let Islam flourish. Let atheism flourish. It can't hurt us. We have religious freedom on paper, right? Not all religions are the same, and we're seeing that in spades now, aren't we? It's time for another crusade. Not all ways of salvation meet the summit of the mountain, right? All paths lead to the tolerance on diversity. All paths lead to the summit of the mountain? I'm afraid not. And secondly, application for discipleship, it serves as a check too. Remember from whence you've come as you begin to enjoy the fruits of the kingdom. The arrogance of redemption and salvation, indeed the temptation to lapse and relapse into lethargy and apathy. I see this, I go home to my Dutch Reformed community, and the presumption of salvation, covenantal presumption, is rife. And many of the Reformed churches in our region need to be shaken awake, because covenantal presumption indeed is a temptation. So for discipleship, this idea of works, indeed, there is no salvation and redemption in works. You are not automatically saved just because you are born in a covenant home. That was Israel's temptation. You who are under it are also accountable to it. Then point number two here, works. The verdict of the law of God is that, owing to your imperfect performance of it, you under it know sin by it, but cannot be justified through obedience to it. You know sin by it, but you cannot be justified by obedience to it. Now, once again, Paul begins verse 20 with a deductive preposition. I hope you're learning your English grammar here as we go through the book of Romans, because Paul, once again, in building sustained, complex, overlapping arguments, uses an argumentative structure, a logical structure in all of his chapters, so we need to be aware of this. And verse 20 then begins with this deductive preposition for, and it indicates that what follows in verse 20 serves as the ground, the basis for the truth that he's just stated in 19. Every mouth is stopped and the whole world is accountable to God. Precisely because by means of obedience to works of the law, no man will be justified in God's sight. That's why every mouth should be stopped, even as they were stopped at Jesus' feet with a woman taken in adultery. And that's how it'll be at the judgment throne. If not here. Because keep in mind now our dilemma, our human dilemma. We will all be judged by how perfectly our works matched the standard of the law. We will be judged by how perfectly our works matched the standard of the law in order to be justified. Some Christians get confused here when you say, we'll all be judged by our works. No, Pastor, I'll be judged by grace. No, you'll be judged by works. The grace comes in when Christ substitutes his works for yours, his perfect record for yours. I never understood this completely until I was better taught by Reformed teachers. There's a two-sided aspect to the coin of salvation. Why did Jesus die on the cross? To forgive me of my sins, to save me of my sins. Yeah, well, that's one side. Indeed, we are cleansed from our sin. But that's pretty much all evangelicals learn, I'm afraid, in their teaching of redemption and salvation and propitiation and justification. Well, he forgave me of my sins. Yes, but he also gave you the righteousness that is utterly requisite for you. When I work with kids, I find this to be an effective illustration for kids. So it might be effective for adults too. I say when you get up on Sunday morning, take a bath or a shower. You cleanse yourself from dirt from the body. But then do you just step out of the tub and come right to church? No. You know, this kind of, no, Pastor. No, you put on a set of clean clothes, too. And redemption and salvation is of the same model, an analogy, if you will. Surely, God cleanses you of your sin, but then he also endows you with a righteousness. It's white robes is the image used throughout the Bible. So there is that two aspect nature to salvation. You're cleansed of your sin, but you're also endowed with the perfect righteousness that is utterly requisite for you if you are going to be in God's presence through eternity. Revelation is full of that picture, if you will, of the saints, the redeemed saints, in their glistening robes. So keep in mind that dilemma that we are faced with. We will be judged by how perfectly our works match the standard of the law in order to be justified. Hypothetically, it is achievable by the individual, hypothetically. Certainly, Adam in his created state could have done this. While hypothetically it is possible to keep the works of the law to perfection, practically speaking, no man since Adam has been able to. In fact, we all fall miserably short of it, do we not? Paul will further unfold this in chapter 5. He'll bring Adam back and compare him to the first Adam to the second Adam. So we'll camp on Adam here shortly. But one of my favorite examples of self-justification or self-salvation is the swimmer's analogy. I just gave you the bather's analogy. There's also a swimmer's analogy in terms of our self-justification or self-salvation. Now remember, this is only an analogy, okay? An apocryphal story, if you will. Suppose that we all trundled down to swim from the coast of California to Hawaii, just lined up as a congregation. Some of us would get further than others, wouldn't we? Because we're stronger swimmers. An Olympic athlete like Bruce Jenner or maybe I'll get arrested now for calling him Bruce instead of Caitlin. But an Olympic athlete like Bruce Jenner might get much further than any of us. Maybe not anymore, but there was a day when he could have. But the practicality of the matter is that eventually, I'm sorry, not really, but sooner or late, all of us would tire and drown, wouldn't we? Far, far short of our goal, Hawaii. What good is boasting then? The gap between God's perfection and our performance of it, I would submit to you, is infinitely greater than the distance between California and Hawaii. The law properly takes the measure of us in comparison to the obedience expected of us. This is in part the value of the law taken as a whole as well. I encourage you, when you think of the law, don't think of blah, 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 a list of commands. Because not only do we have the law as command, do this and you will live, disobey and you shall die, that kind of thing, but we also have the law as revealing the glory of God. And this Israel understood. Every Israelite would have understood that Torah did this too. And oftentimes we don't factor in the nature of the law as bringing glory to God. The entire culture of Torah was thought of and included when the law was considered. The entire culture of Torah, the temple system of worship with its golden glories, the smells of incense and roasting meat, the beauties of the Levitical choirs and the chants at the altars. We encountered this when we went through, preached and sung through Psalms, right? And then, of course, the blessings and beauties of daily family and community life. This was part of Torah. It certainly was a blessing to be a member of an Israelite family in those days when you had the law of God, the ordered law of God, with its justice and demonstration of care and concern for the poor and the immigrant and so forth. All of this, it was a blessing to live in Israel. As each individual Israelite strove to live out Torah in his village and synagogue, and Israel was blessed when they did this. It was a beautiful thing to see and behold. This is all what we mean when we talk about the law. The living festivals as well were an integral part of Torah, in which the average Israelite found joy and fellowship in his family and community. Abundance of food and drink, familiar, regular ritual, calendar celebration. We're wired for ritual. We're wired for calendar, for the recurring dates and festivals of calendar. The law was a living parable of God's saving work. So, this too is law. And the objective observer would exclaim, you know, even as the Queen of Sheba did when she came, any Gentile that would come and visit Israel would see this around him and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us whenever we call upon him? What great nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law that I set before you today? When they put shoe leather on it, when they lived it, in temple and festival and community and the house, synagogue, it was a wonderful thing, glorious and beautiful thing to behold. So it is not just law as laid down, but law as lived out that brings glory to God and justification to man. And in it all, however, Israel fell short. Israel fell short, time and time again. And Paul's saying that this should have issued then for you, it should have issued in a stark, clear conclusion. What might that have been? What was the conclusion they should have arrived at? That Torah was somehow inadequate? No, Paul, time and time again, counters that, doesn't he? He said, no, it's not the law that's inadequate. The law is beautiful and perfect. Heaven forbid, Paul says. Is the law then contrary to the promise of God? Certainly not. For if a law had been given that could give life, see, now we're getting somewhere. For if a law had been given that could give life, then righteousness would have been indeed been by the law, Paul says in Galatians. Well, Torah's not inadequate, then maybe we just need to try a little harder. Okay? Give us another crack at the land of Israel. And we'll get it right this time, right? Time and time again, all through the book of Judges, they disobey, fall into gross sin, taken over by the Philistines, right? The cycle time and time again, all through the book of Judges. Well, give us another run at it, okay? So they get another run at it. Into exile they go, into Babylon. Give us another chance, God. Let us have another crack at the land, okay? Let us try again. So they get another crack at it again. What happens? They crucify the Messiah. Well, let us have another chance, 1948. Let us have another chance, right? And then Christians make hay with it in dispensationalism as well. It ain't going to work. It's like Marxism, right? Marxists today say, well, they just didn't do it right in Russia, right? You talk to Marxists today, and there's plenty of them circulating running around in America today. They just didn't do it right in Russia. Well, they didn't do it right in China either. No, they didn't do it right in Kampuchea. They killed 2 million of their own people. They just, you know, off a little bit. The stark, clear conclusion that Paul draws is the one that they should have drawn. Through the law comes knowledge of sin. Through the law comes knowledge of sin. Yea, the law verily shouts sinner. If you have your eyes open, knowing what the law should achieve and accomplish, how very far fall, very far short the sinner falls, the law just reaffirms sinner. As glorious, as beautiful as the law is, we are not in our performance of it. The Gentile has a stunted, incomplete law written on his heart. A vestigial remains of that which Adam, as a part of his upright nature, had before the fall. That stunted, incomplete law, as we saw in chapter 1, serves to sink that Gentile in sin, not save him from it. The Jew, on the other hand, has the complete law of God in all of its glory. He knows who this God of glory and holiness is. It's been revealed to him. He knows sin in all of its specificity when it is committed. Covetousness, adultery, theft, blasphemy. He knows the height, the depth to which it offends and angers that God. He knows, as I've sketched for you, tried to sketch for you when all cylinders were firing, he knows the lavish blessings that are the creatures when he obeys. But he also knows the devastating curses when he disobeys. He also knows, or at least he should know, that in light of who this God is, the law he's entrusted to them as stewards, that they fall very far short of it. They cannot keep this law and therefore cannot be justified by obedience to it. Therefore, by this law, they know sin. That's what Paul is saying. Therefore, by this law, they know sin, not salvation by mere possession of it. On this side of the cross, we know this as well. In you, as well as those lost men and women to whom we appeal, in every soul of every sinner who comes to Christ, there's an epiphany, isn't there? There's a dawning realization, a moment of clarity when he comes to this conclusion. And if that friend, loved one, neighbor, workmate that you're working with hasn't had that moment of clarity when he realizes, man, I'm a sinner. I am lost, right? then you need to work patiently with him yet again till he comes to that epiphany. All of my strutting goodness is for naught. It's worthless. It amounts to nothing in God's eyes. I'll never be able to work to be good enough. Another apocryphal story. Guy dies and standing before St. Peter at the gate. How many stories, apocryphal stories, begin with that, right? That's why it's apocryphal, because it ain't going to happen that way. But for the sake of the story, he's standing before St. Peter, and St. Peter has the books open. And he says, "Well, Peter, are you going to let me in?" He says, "Well, if your total points add up to 1,000, then we'll let you in. Now you tell me what you've done." He says, "Well, I gave money to charity." Okay, there's 1 point. So, my goodness. "Well, I was really good to my wife and kids." St. Peter says, "I'll give you 2 points for that." "Well, I helped shovel a neighbor's walk one time." "Well, I'll give you 3 points for that." And he's racking his brain and says, "Man, that's only 994 points that I have to make up." He says, "Oh, no. I said, I can't think of anything else. If I'm going to be saved, it's going to be by grace." Peter says, "Aha, open the doors." What do you think? Yeah, that's an apocryphal story. But that's what our works end up adding up to, right? Naught and worthless. If I'm going to be saved, it's going to be by a miracle. Aha. Now you're talking. Works righteousness, my good works, the bad deeds I haven't done, my good intentions, my feelings toward people and God, all of these and their children populate the mistaken expectations of what will stand in the judgment, don't they? How many variations on works righteousness do you hear from lost men and women? "I'm not as bad as some. I haven't robbed the bank. I haven't murdered anybody. My good works, my good intentions and feelings, too, towards people." That was my mother's block there for a time as well. "All of these and their children populate the mistaken expectations of what will stand in the judgment. And so we must be rigorous and ruthless in a nice way." You can be a velvet brick, okay? But be truthful and gracious in clearing these from the field of the hearts of our friends and our neighbors and relatives. What will stand then? What will stand? If none of my works, none of what I can do will contribute to my justification, my righteousness in any way, shape, or form, what will stand? Am I left in despair and hopelessness of ever being saved? Well, once again, rather than giving you all the cookies now on the lower shelf, we are going to wait until next week to begin unfolding in a more complete manner, because the rest of chapter 3 is just a beautiful gem of redemption. Roger and I were going through the work of Christ in Packer's book, Concise Theology. And as we are going through each of those chapters, they keep coming back to chapter 3. On the work of Christ's redemption. This is a rich and dense and multi-layered, multifaceted gem of redemption and salvation, chapter 3. So we're going to spend some time in it, but do not despair. Because indeed, Paul brings us right to this very point in verse 21, where he says, "But now the righteousness of God has been manifested." Where have we heard that before? It's a thematic verse from chapter 1, verse 17, right? "A righteousness of God has been revealed now from heaven." Paul is now returning to that thematic verse and that theme. A righteousness from God has been revealed and manifest is the word that's translated here. What is that righteousness then? And how has it been revealed? Here is our delight, brothers and sisters. Here is our joy. There is hope. There is promise for the righteousness of God that is so requisite for the salvation of your soul, for the salvation of the souls of your friends and neighbors and relatives. Very clear. So we'll unpack it, begin unpacking it then, it's in its multifaceted nature, next week. But for now, let us come to that place where we find that righteousness of God provided in the body and blood of Christ, now in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.